villainous way of continuing the interview with Simon Strauss in Lenox, Massachusetts on August 27th, 1994. Let's just make sure that we don't have static. Now, you had mentioned Mauricio Hochschild. Was there a connection with the other Hochschilds in the mining field?
Yes, Mauricio was a cousin of the Hochschilds, who were very prominent in the management of American Metal Company in the early part of the century. I believe the one who came over to the United States from Germany was named Berthold, that's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, Hochschild. And it was his two sons, Harold and, I'll give you the other first name later, who were very well known in the mining and metals business for many years, right up into the 1960s. Berthold Hochschild was sent to the United States from Frankfurt by Metallgesellschaft, the large German mining and metals trading organization. Simultaneously, Metallgesellschaft had also opened an office in London under the name of British Metal Corporation. And the ties between the Frankfurt office and the offices in London and New York were extremely close prior to World War I. The war, of course, changed all that, and it was necessary for the ties to be broken. The alien property custodians in both countries insisted that these corporations be divested of their German corporate ownership. However, following the peace in 1918, business connections did resume. As an example, I had mentioned the Norddeutsche copper refinery in Germany. The ownership of that corporation, of that refinery, was for a long time shared between Metallgesellschaft and either British Metal Corporation or an affiliated company it formed called Amalgamated Metal Corporation. There were, I'm sure, many tax or other corporate reasons for having this multitude of companies, but the ties in terms of doing business together were restored. However, Metallgesellschaft, as a German corporation, so far as I know, had no further stock investment in either American Metal Company or British Metal.
Were there still the family connections, though?
There were some family connections, I'm sure. And I don't know enough to give you a detail, but the management of American Metal Company for many years was in the hands of people who had emigrated to the United States from Germany, including Ludwig Vogelstein and subsequently his nephew Hans Vogelstein. There was Dr. Otto Sussmann, S-U-S-S-M-A-N, who was president of American Metal for years. And then there were the Loeb brothers. There was Carl and Julius Loeb. The Loebs left American metal management during the Depression of the 30s. Carl Loeb then went into the securities business and founded the very successful stock brokerage firm of Loeb Rhodes and Company, which has since been absorbed in Wall Street's multitudinous amalgamations and mergers. But Carl Loeb's son, John Loeb, was considered one of the leaders of Wall Street during the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So the influence of the original German connection persisted in the American Metal Company for many years. It began to change in the 50s when American Metal was merged with the Climax Molybdenum Company. American Metal had played a role originally in the development of the Climax mine, but it was for many years run by a separate corporation, Climax Molybdenum Corporation, in which American Metal had a stock interest, but which there was also broad public participation. The exact date of the merger between American Metal and Climax, I don't remember, but after that merger, the name of the company was changed from American Metal to Amex. Mm.
Were any of these people connected with the Guggenheims?
No. There was no connection whatever. The Guggenheims were not German origin, they were Swiss. Mm. Meyer Guggenheim, who was the progenitor, let us say, of the whole Guggenheim clan, was a lace merchant from Switzerland who settled in Philadelphia. And they had had no previous experience in the metals business until he was persuaded by someone to make an investment in silver mines in Leadville, Colorado.
But these people had been, these others had been in metal trading
for a long time.
Centuries?
Yes. Well, Metall Gesellschaft goes back to the early part of the 19th century, and I think many of them had been involved in metal trading. Mm-hmm. But the most colorful of them all was certainly Mauricio Boccia. And since you are interested in anecdotes, let me tell you one of the really amusing anecdotes about Mauricio Boccia.
Did you know him well?
I knew him very well. I had met him as a child because he was a friend of my father's when he first came to South America. Born in Germany, educated at Freiburg, the very well-known mining school in Germany, Mauricio first went to Russia and later to Western Australia, but in 1911, the year I was born, he came to South America, and thereafter that was the center of his activities. In due course, he established a firm foothold, not only as a metal trader, but as an operator of tin mines in Bolivia. And from there he branched out until he had mining operations in Brazil, Argentina, Peru, and Chile, as well as in Bolivia. He had trading companies also in Colombia and possibly elsewhere in Latin America. He was a very impressive gentleman. With the rise of Hitler in Germany, Mauricio Hochschild, who was not a practicing Jew, but nevertheless of Jewish descent, was one of the leaders in rescuing Jews from the German Dominion. And more than that, he resolved not to do business with Germany. Hmm. He used to travel frequently to Europe, nevertheless, to participate in discussions with people in the metals business, since he sold ores and concentrates, plus tin metal in Europe. In June of 1940, when the Germans broke through the Maginot Line and were threatening to take over Paris, Mauricio Hochschild was actually staying at the Meurice Hotel, no connection, M-E-U-R-I-C-E, hotel in Paris, where he was a frequent visitor, well known to the staff, extremely generous in terms of gratuities. When it appeared that Paris was about to fall, Mauricio recognized that if he was still there when the Germans entered the city, he would face the probability of being executed because of not only the fact that he was Jewish, but that he had refused to do business with the Germans. So he went to the concierge at the hotel and said that he understood that that afternoon there was a airplane flight out of Paris to London, and he wanted a seat on that plane if it was at all possible, no matter what the cost. The concierge, who was very friendly toward Mauricio, said, "Come back in an hour and I'll let you know." When he returned, the concierge said, "I managed to get you a seat," and although Hochschild had been prepared to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars for a seat, the extra cost turned out to be $10 over the nominal price. That afternoon he went out to the airport, Le Bourget, to get on his plane, and the departure was being delayed because in all the confusion, some cargo was being loaded into the cargo compartment. Being of a very curious frame of mind and assuming that these wooden boxes contained the gold reserves of the Bank of France, Mauricio asked one of the workmen what was in the boxes. You will be astonished at the reply. Bear in mind that this is June. The cargo was wild strawberries consigned to the Claridge Hotel in London. Undoubtedly, the Claridge Hotel had a standing order with some fruit dealer for shipment of wild strawberries every June, which are a delicacy and people pay great prices to enjoy their wild strawberries. So the order had probably been repeated at the end of the previous June when the world was at peace and routines had gone forward. Nobody had countermanded it. So on the last commercial flight out of Paris to London, on the fateful day before the Germans occupied the city, Mauricio Hochschild, the international metal trader, successfully got out of Paris, sitting in a plane loaded with wild strawberries.
Oh my word! Viva La France!
Viva the Claridge Hotel!
Yes, yes. Did he told that story?
Oh yes, he told me that story, and he told me a lot of others were very amusing. He was a great raconteur. He was extremely fond of my wife Elaine, and he was very concerned about her limited health.
What happened to him?
Well, he died in the late 60s, early 70s. Peaceful death in his 80th or 83rd year.
Where?
In Paris, as it turned out. Mm-hmm. Although he spent most of his time in South America or in the United States. He had, after the war, with all the complications of exchange controls and taxes, he had formed a holding company based in the Bahamas in order to avoid a lot of the complications that existed. He had companies in each of the countries in which he operated, and most of them maintained their accounts in pound sterling, but the shares were quoted in terms of par in Swiss francs, and most of the products were sold in dollars. And he was an expert at dealing with all these problems.
Did he have heirs who took over the business?
He had a son. But what I wanted to tell you, to show you the kind of generous and compassionate man he was as an individual, although as a metals trader he was merciless in dealing with the people with whom he dealt. He had an apartment at Cable Beach in Nassau in the Bahamas, which stood empty most of the year. He used it when they had to have their semi-annual board meetings in the Bahamas in order to comply with Bahama law, Bahamian regulations. He said to me one day, he said, you know, your wife would really be very comfortable and happy in the suite that I have, or in the apartment that I have in Cable Beach, and it's at your disposal whenever you and she would like to go there. I said, Don Mauricio, that's a very generous offer, but the fact is that Elaine sleeps only in a hospital bed, and she's not comfortable in an ordinary bed, and it's very hard to take care of her except in a hospital bed. He said, well, how do I go about getting a hospital bed? And I said, well, I'm not familiar with Nassau, but perhaps if one of your people would make inquiries at the hospital, they might have a spare bed that they could rent. A few weeks later, he said to me, we got in touch with the hospital, and he said there were tears in their eyes when they described how desperately short they are of hospital beds. So he said, I agreed that I would give them a hospital bed, but I thought I would buy it in the United States, ship it down, and let Elaine use it first before turning it over to the hospital.
Okay.
So in fact, the only vacations that Elaine had outside the United States after her illness were in Nassau. Mm-hmm. On one occasion, we spent 2 weeks in the apartment that he had fully staffed. And this was the kind of thing that he did. He established what he called the University in Exile in connection with the New School for Social Research in New York, and arranged to have numbers of German and French academics who fled from Hitler brought to the United States and teach at that university. So he was a quite remarkable man.
That's wonderful. Were any of these people related were the Vogelsteins, for instance, and the Hochschilds and the, you mentioned
the Loebs.
The Loebs and the Vogelsteins were related.
I'm not sure. There may have been some intermarriage between them. I have a sense, and I can't offer this as fact. I have a sense that in fact the Hochschild's in the American Medal and the Loeb's did not get along all that well. I think there was some dissension about the Climax mine at one point. And I believe when the Loebs left American Metal Management in 1929, 1930, I'm not sure of the date, they may well have been forced out by the Hochschilds.
Hochschilds or Vogelsteins?
The Hochschilds.
Hochschilds, oh,
yeah.
Okay.
A Vogelstein was the president at the time, but the Hochschilds were the big shareholders.
They had interests in it.
Yeah. I can't assert that this is so. It's just an impression that I have.
You might want to mention, too, there were a couple of things that we had talked about that you wanted to say about Mr. Hines.
Oh, yes. I mentioned that in the post-war period, Sarko's representative in Germany was Hugo Hines.
He stayed in Germany all through the war?
No. He was actually in Brussels when the war broke out. He had been working with Roger Hecht in Brussels. And when the Germans invaded Belgium and Holland, Roger Hecht, his wife, and his small children were able to escape. They made their way first to France and then, under great difficulty, to Portugal. And eventually sailed to the United States.
Well, where they were Jewish.
They were Jewish. Where Roger became affiliated with the U.S. Office of Metal Traders and worked there during the war. However, Roger's brother Guido, G-U-I-D-O, and his mother were still in Brussels when the Germans came through. And Roger told me in the post-war era that Hugo Hines, who had been associated with him and who kept the office open for a time, played a key role in saving his mother and his brother's life. In spite of the fact that he did so at great risk, the kind of thing that was described so movingly in the diary of
Frank.
It was a similar situation. We had no problem in Sarko in being represented by Mr. Hines. There was no hint of his ever having any kind of Nazi connection.
The people that Hochschild helped to get out, did he get them to Latin America or to North America?
Both. Yes. Most, because of the quotas in effect, most of the Jewish immigrants he helped settled in Bolivia, Peru, Chile. Many of them went to work in his organizations. And in due course, they rose to be the managers of his organization. He had been married to two different ladies on three occasions. That is to say, he married one lady twice. His second wife, the one that I knew, was of Belgian origin.
I'm sorry,
right.
I didn't. That's okay. That's
fine.
Okay.
Was his second wife, a Belgian lady, a charming woman. For a while they lived on Long Island, or had a house on Long Island, And she lived there more or less year-round, but of course he was constantly traveling and come home. I remember very vividly the occasion of his 75th birthday party, because his wife arranged to use the ballroom of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. It was the last social function held at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, which was then on 43rd or 44th Street before it was torn down. And the group that were there were primarily Dr. Hochschild's friends in the mining and metals industry. There may have been 100 people at this black tie affair with orchestra and dancing and professional entertainment. And Elaine and I went down and stayed overnight at the hotel because it would have been too late for her to go home. And it was a fine occasion. He was in great spirits. Mrs. Hochschild died shortly thereafter. He gave up the house on Long Island, but maintained a suite in the Ambassador Hotel on Park Avenue, which is, I think, where the Seagram's building is now. And we would come in to have dinner with him every so often. He had taken a great interest in a fellow named Dr. Ross, who was a magician. Every time we came to have dinner with him, there would be Dr. Ross taking cards out of our sleeves or confusing us with all kinds of magic tricks. I don't think that Dr. Hochschild really was so interested in magic, except that he felt sorry for this gentleman, and he would take him on as an evening's entertainer for a group of 8 or 10 people. That would be all there would be there. And we would be exposed to the kind of performance that usually you'd see in a theater with hundreds of people watching.
His business still exists?
His business still exists, but following his death, he left his estate basically to his associates. His only son, who lived in London, had been in the business for a short time, but was not very adept at it, and managed to annoy or harass many of the other people in the business to the extent that Dr. Hochschild recognized that it wasn't working. So he suggested to Gerald, that's the son's name, that he find something else to do, and paid him several million dollars as a sort of a severance pay or an advance on his inheritance. So following his death, when the will was read, and it was discovered that he had left only a fraction of his estate to Gerald, Gerald decided to challenge it in the court on the grounds that he had died in France, and that French law should prevail, and that under French law you cannot disinherit your children. They're entitled to, I don't know, a third of the estate or something like that. I offered my good services, since I had no interest in the matter one way or the other, to try to intervene between Gerald and the people who were really running the business. I had a most unsatisfactory talk with him. He was not interested in any kind of compromise, so I haven't seen him since that one meeting that I had with him. But eventually, the business continued with the partner who was in charge of the Buenos Aires office, I think, as sort of pro-chairman for a period of time. And then when the Anglo-American decided to become interested in the Western Hemisphere, they made an offer for and actually took over much of the business, not all of it. I think his nephew still runs the Peruvian end of the business.
What, it was called Hope Shield?
Yes, it had various names.
Various names.
The Brazilian office, which represented ASARCO for our sales of refined metals in Brazil, was run by a very nice gentleman named Ralph Weinberg. And I think perhaps the name was Brasimet, B-R-A-S-I-M-E-T. Mm-hmm. But it was part of this Hochschild group, and the umbrella Bahamian Corporation still existed. It was called South American Mines Consolidated or some such name. But it was that corporation that was bought by Anglo-American, except that apparently some deal was worked out. I'm not familiar with the detail under which the Peruvian business continued as an independent under the administration of Dr. Hochschild's nephew, Luis Hochschild, or as he was called by his friends, Lucho.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen Lucho in the last few years, but
it's interesting.
The last I knew, he was doing quite well. Mm-hmm. He's the one that worked out the treatment of the tailings as they came down the stream from Tocopala. Mm-hmm. You remember
right,
talking about
that.
Mm-hmm. So you can see how everything gets intermeshed and interwoven in the industry.
I
greatly enjoyed my contacts with Dr. Hochschild, even though, as I said, when I left Washington and he wanted me to join his organization, I felt I would be happier at ASARCO. But we often traveled together. I would see him when I was in Paris if he happened to be there. And we met frequently in both New York and Washington. Saying that he was going to undertake the writing of a biography of Mauricio Hochschild, he asked if he could meet me, and I, of course, replied I'd be glad to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
When that's going to happen and whether it will materialize, who knows? But his life was a fascinating one. He was a truly international person.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually became a citizen of Argentina. Yet he had his corporation scattered all over South America. He was all the time in Europe or the United States and occasionally in Japan. I sometimes said of him to his face that he was the Basil Zakharov of the mining business. Do you know who Basil Zakharov
was?
No,
I don't think I do.
Basil Zakharov, that's Zaharoff, was a mysterious businessman who reportedly made a fortune during World War I dealing in munitions.
Mm-hmm.
Mauricio never dealt in munitions. But his methods of doing business were in some ways somewhat similar to Basil Zakharov's, having a lot of different corporate names under which to operate. I'm not suggesting that Don Mauricio did anything that was illegal. but he took advantage of every available tax loophole or currency regulation he could. At one time in his life, he was in Bolivia. The Bolivian government accused him of traitorous behavior with respect to currency dealings. He was imprisoned in La Paz, and for a while it was thought that he might well be executed. But he managed to escape. His associates found ways of getting him released. And I'm not sure that he ever went back to Bolivia after that. Yet he had some wonderful, fantastic ideas about Bolivia. You may know there's a lake called Lake Titicaca on the border between Peru and Bolivia. And it's the largest lake at that elevation, 12,000 feet or something. Mauricio Hochschild was fascinated with the possibilities of generating power by building dams and releasing some of the water from Titicaca to generate electric power. He spent a lot of time. One of the causes to which he gave a lot of money and a great deal of time after the European Economic Union was set up, he proposed that Latin America do the same thing. And he engaged a former president of Chile, paid him a salary, had him travel around to work on this idea. So he was a true visionary, a man of great skill.
Perhaps I should have mentioned this before, but just apropos of the fact that I recently read a book about the mafia, I was just wondering, was there ever any entrance of the mafia into the international metal business that you know of?
Not that I know of. I'm not aware of anything. My guess is that if they had, it probably would have been in scrap trading. But I'm not aware of it with regard to primary metal production.
I'm sure you wouldn't have been approached directly yourself, but I just wondered if there was ever rumors of mafia pressure or involvement.
After the price of silver rose above the melting point, the Treasury was...
That's the point at which melting the coins down is
face value of the silver, of the coin was less than the value of the Canadian silver.
Right.
There was, for a time, a Treasury regulation making it illegal to melt coins. This remained on the books for maybe 3 or 4 years. And there were rumors of possible criminal elements that were carrying on. The Canadians had adopted, because they also had silver coinage, they had adopted similar measures. It was illegal to melt down U.S. coins in the United States, but it wasn't illegal to melt down Canadian coins in the U.S., nor was it illegal to melt down U.S. coins in Canada. And there were various rumors of groups that were carrying coins across the border, melting Canadian coins in this country, melting U.S. coins in Canada. It may very well have happened, but that's as
close as I... Probably not a large scale.
Well, there was a lot of money. Once silver got to $3 or $4 an ounce, a coin was worth two or more times as much dead as alive. And of course, one of the interesting things about melting coins is the more coins get melted down, the more the numismatic value of the surviving coin becomes. comes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I still have the bulk of the coins that I put aside years ago. And every now and then I look at them and wonder what I ought to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Of course, gold smuggling has been a an industry of many countries.
And probably there was some illicit dealings in gold in the days when it was illegal to hold gold, private citizens to hold gold in the United States. There may well have been. But in today's freer markets, there wouldn't be any point in smuggling. You don't need to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
All right.